Hello, and welcome to this PERspectives Continuing Education Podcast, created by healthcare professionals for healthcare professionals. PER is a leader in healthcare education and offers free accredited medical education programs in a variety of accessible formats at gotoper.com.
Well, thank you for being here, and thank you for joining us tonight. We're very fortunate to have the speakers that we do. They know about this illness very well, both from a care standpoint and from their extensive research, reading and writing the research for the treatment of patients with ALK-positive lung cancer. I think you saw in the earlier talks today, there, I think, still is some question, what's the best way to treat people from the get-go? We heard from Dr. Gaynor before, and we'll hear from him again. Also, there's clearly a role for multidisciplinary care here. The idea is about treating oligometastases and the benefit of treating oligometastases in driver positive cancers really came from work with ALK and EGFR. Some of it from Dr. Yu at Sloan Kettering for EGFR, and also the folks from Mass General for the ALK. It also dovetails into what is the right testing. It's an evolving field. I think you saw in some of the earlier talks of the different methodologies, and it's one where we have a lot of choices and we can get the answer very quickly. So I have a term now for a lot of what we do, that things are better for patients, but harder for us. More choices, more decisions, we have to be prepared to do that. So with that, we'll start first with Dr. Helena Yu from MSK, talking about the molecular testing for the ALK rearrangements.
So I will have a very short time to discuss molecular testing in ALK-positive lung cancer. Here are my disclosures. Okay, so this is a case of someone I saw this year. So JB presented to the ED when she had an acute episode of hemoptysis while golfing. CT to rule out PE demonstrated a right hilar consolidation and a 1.2 centimeter pretracheal lymph node. Path from the biopsy demonstrated that the hilar mass lymph nodes 2R, 4R, and 11R were all positive for adenocarcinoma. PET indicated multiple osseous metastases, and MRI brain showed two punctate lesions in the left frontal lobe. Molecular results from both the liquid biopsy and the bronch tumor specimen were sent out and are pending. She continues to have small volume but intermittent persistent hemoptysis. So I'm going to pose questions to my colleagues or anyone on the floor. As our oncologist, do you have time to wait for molecular results in this person? Pretest probability is high for a targetable mutation. How quickly on average do you get molecular results from the assays that you utilize? And what could you do in the interim? I'm going to start with Justin, since the three of us are all at MSK.
Yeah, so do you have time to wait? I would say yes. In someone where you have a high pretest probability for a driver, I would say in this part, even though the title of this whole session's on ALK, I would say the age is also a tip-off here. ALK-positive lung cancer typically affects people of much younger age. So your patients in their 20s and 30s, never smoker, it's going to be a disproportionate number of patients with ALK. How quickly would I get molecular testing results? I have the benefit of being in a big academic center where I can just email my pathologist. This would be a case where I would ask for ALK IHC, which they can turn around in a day. We do have a rapid NGS panel that's over 100 different genes. It typically comes back in 2 days. I recognize that that's not the norm, but that's what I would send in this patient. what would I do in the interim? You know, it sounds like she's having a little hemoptysis. I think usually if you can give these just even some antibiotics many times, that can just resolve the hemoptysis. So I wouldn't be pushing therapy quickly. I would prescribe some antibiotics and send the rapid testing.
So, you know, she, on the bronch that was diagnostic, she did have like an endobronchial lesion and some invasion. So, and she had persistent hemoptysis. So we decided to refer her back, refer her to radiation oncology for palliative RT. She got some, RT over 5 fractions, hemoptysis result. So I have 2 different liquid biopsy results. So I just wanted to ask my panel if they treat these differently. So her liquid biopsy, assay comes back and it's negative. And then you can see on the bottom, which often is the case where we don't see a clear driver, but we see some kind of quote random or sort of nonspecific mutations. Marker is, do you guys treat these two differently? Do they mean anything different to you? What would you do?
So, I definitely, the first thing is that I wouldn't knee-jerk sort of make the conclusion that this patient does not harbor a driver alteration based on the fact that we didn't see ALK or EGFR, any of the drivers that you might expect to see in this patient. Just because a liquid biopsy is negative does not mean that the tissue is not going to reveal anything. And sometimes we see things like this, and tissue is really the gold standard. So I still would pump the brakes on planning systemic therapy. In regards to having these maybe variants of unknown significance or passenger alterations, somebody with this history, I still would often refer to our genetics team, and I would run to see if there was any germline alterations, and I would be very curious to see if these were found on her tissue next generation sequencing. But I wouldn't use this to drive my treatment recommendations or think that this might be a different primary than we are expecting.
Yeah, that was just the main point I wanted to make. I think that I've seen referrals where there are some mutations on the NGS panel, and then we say, oh, they were driver mutation negative versus the top where there's nothing, we know obviously to look further. But I think the challenge, and I'm sure all of us are seeing this, is people can have clonal hematopoiesis mutations or other things as well. So it's really, you know, I don't treat those differently. I think, as is said, this just means we need to look further.
I think the other point to make there is like ctDNA assays are much more sensitive to picking up SNVs, like the p53 there, versus a fusion, right? So, you know, your fusions, just lower sensitivity for fusion events.
Yeah, absolutely. I think kind of copy number and those fusions are more challenging. Liquid biopsies.
Yeah, and again, please remember that the liquid is about 75% of the tissue. And again, just to reiterate what Justin said, but one thing about ALK though is the ALK IHC is unbelievably accurate and effective. I know at our end it can be done anywhere, and as Justin said, you get it back in a day. We have it done reflexively on every adenocarcinoma, so we get this back right away. And I didn't understand this, but the reason is you really don't have any ALK. When you're an adult. So the test is very, very good. There's not, if you see any staining there, you know it's positive.
All right, perfect. So you call because you're waiting for that tumor tissue NGS, but it fails. And so you do need to send out a second sample. Results will take at least another 2 weeks. Now she's symptomatic. She has pain at the site of her L5 metastasis. What would you do now? Would you guys continue to wait, or what would you do in the interim? Justin?
I assume you did a spine MRI and it's a bony met. It's
correct.
Not, there's no,
you know, like starting
neural,
to have some epidural
neural
extension.
Neural compromise there. Yeah. It is L5, so you don't have to worry quite as much.
Yeah. I mean, I think, not to keep beating this point, just because tissue is insufficient for NGS doesn't mean that you can't do more molecular testing on it, right? So I think it's always worth a conversation with your, molecular pathologist, while maybe there weren't 10 to 20 slides for the NGS, maybe there is enough, you know, for, you know, ALK, ROS, RET, you know, testing and rapid EGFR, right? That can actually cover a lot of the alterations that you're worried about. So that would be my first call to the pathologist is, well, we can't do the NGS, but what about these other things? I'd probably be ordering another biopsy just because my pretest probability is so high. Once I get the biopsy, I think the question is, how bad is her pain versus like, and do I just start platinum pemetrexed, you know, once I've gotten the biopsy, or can we give a little RT? The concern with RT is always, you know, just by the time you finish it, is something else going to pop up? I can't remember the details of all of her scans. So I think it would depend on the burden of disease that I was seeing on the scans.
Yeah. And I think that exactly what Justin said, I think, you know, if she's not that symptomatic, it's a lot of reassurance because in terms of outcomes, you know, it wouldn't matter if you started treatment today or a few weeks from now. But when I'm thinking about patients that have a very high pretest probability for having a driver mutation, I would do exactly what Justin mentioned and what I wrote here. I'd give her platinum doublet chemotherapy and I'd omit the immunotherapy, the PD-1 inhibitor for the first cycle, knowing that, you know, obviously if NGS came back negative, truly negative, and there was no driver, we found a KRAS driver, we could always add that in with cycle two. And so I just wanted to...
Quick question.
Yeah, go ahead.
What's the best thinking treatment for hemoptysis? You know, lung cancer as it is, but it's such an emotional issue for us. Radiation, I think I would choose too, but also I'm concerned, sometimes the tumor is walling off, you have a hyper response, you have more hemoptysis. So my thinking, can I seal that bleed with some radiation? And what's your thinking about hemoptysis? Because
yeah, can be devastating. Absolutely. I mean, I think my, like with sort of scanned hemoptysis for my patients with stage four lung cancer, you know, cough suppression and antibiotics would be the first thing that I would try. If you have a good interventional pulmonologist that you work with, because exactly like you said, I think there are endobronchial, you know, maneuvers or interventions. And I do find, although not, you know, radiation has modest success. I don't know if anyone else on the panel has other magic things, but it's a tough thing.
Yeah, and again, please make sure there isn't any coagulation issue there because of the back pain. She hasn't been taking a bottle of Advil or things like that.
Yeah. I put this slide out there up there just to really show, like, you know, we think at least at MSK, sometimes our molecular results take a while and we forget just how many steps there are in terms of getting those results, right? So for us, it's biopsy, sample collection, preparation of a sample, FFPE, and then we do all the diagnostic stains first. And then only after the diagnostic stains, including some of the IHC, TTF1, P40, then the molecular gets sent out. Slides have to be recut. Then there are, you know, batch shipments or batch kind of runs of NGS. And then it's the computational biologist going over the results and interpreting, and then we see the test. And so there are at least... you know, many, many processes. And that's with NGS and a platform study. But when you start to think about IHC, FISH, it really gets very complicated and managing the tissue is challenging. So in terms of the three things that, three ways that we could identify ALK fusions, we've mentioned them all already. So as Mark said, IHC, we're looking at protein, a simple immunohistochemistry test. There are the standard and more historical DNA-based assays, in particular FISH, which is like a single assay that's looking for a single specific gene rearrangement. DNA-based NGS, which is the standard kind of panels that we send out. And then more recently, there's been the ability to do RNA-based NGS, where we're looking for fusion transcripts. And I realize that the gold standard question is a little bit tricky, but what is the most accurate, able to tell us, you know, both fusion proteins, you know, both the entire fusion protein would be the RNA-based NGS.
Although technically, the clinically validated test is the IHC in FISH.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So in my mind, it's what do you mean by gold standard? Is it, you know, technical performance or the clinical validation?
Right, and the companion diagnostic status. Yep, exactly. So,
one other little Pearl is you often get a hint from the pathology that, again, you wouldn't treat on this, but it tells you you're in the right place and it's time to wait, and that is whether or not they see signet ring cells. They're very characteristic of the ALK. So, I mean, you don't treat based on it, but while you're, it tells you it's okay to wait. There's another thing saying that it's likely to be ALK.
I'll run through the other things pretty quickly just because, you know, everyone knows this, and I'd like to obviously talk much more about management. So historically, first, we use FISH for detecting ALK rearrangements. As Justin said, this is the companion diagnostic, and it's validated on patient samples. And then we can use, obviously, DNA, NGS, and there are good things about this, meaning that we can also concurrently look for other actionable biomarkers our patients might have. But not all fusion products are seen on DNA-based NGS. And then RNA, Archer, or other assays, again, the most sensitive, you get this functional confirmation of the transcription too. And then ALK-IHC, this again is companion diagnostic, and I have these slides just to show you. So ALK positivity can be very obvious. It can be very obviously negative, and then this comes up not infrequently where there is a little bit of expression where our pathologists say ALK-IHC is equivocal. And, we don't treat on that. We're going to be waiting for a follow-up, either FISH to confirm or waiting for NGS results.
Okay.
And I think you saw in the earlier discussions that, these new technologies can give you the fusion results in a matter of days. So, work with your pathologist to try to have that availability with all possible. Justin, you gave a great talk before about, why different, how to treat first line. I don't necessarily want you to reprise it, but I think one thing that would be helpful, if you could, in the next few minutes, talk about is there a case where the sequencing makes sense?
Yep. Yeah, and so I tried to, admittedly, this is a case where I've combined several patients to try to get at that question, and you'll see at the end, we'll walk through this case, and I'll ask initially what would people do. And then at the end, I give a series of what ifs. What if I change some of the history in this way or that way to hopefully get at that question? So this is a 48-year-old woman, presented to the ED with progressive cough, shortness of breath, back pain over 3 months, had previously seen her PCP, for a quote pneumonia, unresponsive to antibiotics. Past medical history here, notable for fibromyalgia, BMI is 31, and a history of depression. Medications are citalopram only. She's married, a corporate attorney, 3 kids, I didn't mention, but a never smoker. In the ED, O2 sats were a little low, 92%. X-ray showed a right lower lung zone opacity, prompting a PE protocol CT. Showed a right lower lobe lung mass, ipsilateral hilar, mediastinal adenopathy, and hepatic hypodensities. Underwent an IR-guided liver biopsy showing, Mark, I did put in the signet ring cells there, so good point. We do ALK-IHC, particularly in someone like this, that was positive. In parallel, had also sent off the NGS, showed an EML4, ALK variant 3, P53, CDK, and 2. In terms of staging, brain MRI showed a 1.4 centimeter rim enhancing lesion in the right cerebellum, as well as 2 to 3 millimeter enhancing lesions in the bilateral cerebral hemisphere. So question, maybe I'll open to the group, what would you use first line therapy for this patient?
Is she have any symptoms? I wasn't paying close attention there.
She has cough and some back pain.
Right. So,
but no neuro symptoms.
Yeah, it sounds like she doesn't have a condition that requires palliation, some kind of critical metastasis. So I would go right to a systemic therapy. I heard your lecture earlier, and you sold me on giving lorlatinib.
Okay.
I would do the same thing, but I guess the things that I noted from her history that I was concerned about is the depression and the obesity, right? Mm-hmm. I think we know that, I mean, all of these drugs can cause weight gain, but those would be two that, you know, wouldn't stop me from doing their lorlatinib, but things to consider.
And something else that was actually missing from her history, but I was looking for, was a history of hyperlipidemia, given her obesity. I just wasn't sure if that was going to be part of it. Not that that would stop me. I agree, lorlatinib is definitely the right answer.
Okay, great. So you guys already saw this slide. So, you know, I spent part of the morning, so I'm not going to belabor the whole, you know, do you sequence or do you use upfront lorlatinib? I think, you know, that's the crux of the matter, right? You know, how do we weigh these options? And so I think, you know, what are the pros and cons of lorlatinib as first line versus the sequencing? So pros, I showed you earlier, it's clearly the strongest efficacy data, right? The strongest CNS data. And the fact that not all patients make it to second line therapy, right? You know, this is just to reiterate, you know, that the 5-year PFS rate, you know, is 60%, you know, the others are in the 40s, right? And showing the CNS data, right? You know, including among patients who don't have brain metastases, that this patient fell into the category of with brain metastases, right? But you can point out, you know, despite even that cerebellar met, right? You know, 83% of patients are without progression in the CNS at 5 years. That can be a big deal for patients, right, and providers alike. This is just to show that, you know, not all, to emphasize the point that not all patients make it to second line therapy, right? So if you look at ALEX and the ALTA-1L study, about 40% of patients didn't receive subsequent therapy. Now, some of that may be, you know, it wasn't captured by the EDC system, but I think this also reflects that there are some patients when they progress, really, really sick. You know, I have a patient right now in the hospital. Anytime she ALK positive, she's young. Anytime she progresses, she develops DIC, gets really hypoxic, and is incredibly sick. And it goes from 0 miles an hour to 60 in a matter of days.
So, well, these are all patients that were fit enough to do a first line trial.
Right.
So, right, so
right.
This is like the creme de la creme.
Right. So I think the cons, though, right, you know, toxicity. And then I think providers and patients alike are always worried about, well, what do I do next, right? You know, there's some comfort in saying, oh, well, I have another line of therapy, right? But what we do see in the CROWN studies, there's increased off-target resistance when you use upfront lorlatinib. This is the toxicity table that I showed before. You know, in this patient, you know, we mentioned the hyperlipidemia, obesity, right? So, you know, it's not trivial, you know, grade 3 weight gain is not trivial, right? It's a substantial weight gain.
Can I comment on a couple of the toxicities? I've always found that the lipid stuff is a paper toxicity.
Totally.
I haven't had a single patient that's ever had a symptomatic problem. And if there is a concern, generally a simple statin usually does the job. And we've been blessed from heaven with a way to deal with the weight now. And it's super critical with all the TKIs to carefully monitor people's weight. And the minute you see that the weight is creeping up, get them on a GLP-1 drug. And if you're lucky, they have diabetes too, so you don't have any trouble getting it. But I've had good success getting it. I haven't had any issues doing that.
Yeah, same. That's been my go-to with weight gain.
And I can't read, by the way, that business about not getting a second treatment, the same thing was seen in the EGFR trials, mm-hmm. that a huge number of people just never got, people that got lorlatinib or gefitinib, they never got the OC.
Yep. Yeah, so for the sake of argument and the completeness, I'm listing here some of the pros and cons of using alectinib or brigatinib as first line. These are not opinions I necessarily hold. But, you know, on the pro side, we'll cite, you know, I do think they're easier to manage, right? We all have some patients, right, who have been on these drugs for years and years and years. And we always have that recall bias of like, oh, yeah, my one patient who's been on for 6-7 years, right? But that's not the, you know, majority of patients. I don't like this idea of saves options. I don't think that's a good argument. You know, the cons are obviously on the efficacy in CNS. So I wanted to return to our case because I recognize, we're around 6:45 and ask a series of what ifs. And maybe ask my colleagues, would your choice of first line therapy change if, with that history of depression, it included a history of suicidality?
No.
It might for me. I mean, it's like how much, like, does she live alone? I had a recent pregnant patient that I was thinking about what to start and like the hormonal shifts postpartum. And I actually just started a lactamid after discussing with her. But, you know, there's that's not a small trivial thing if they don't have good patient support, family support.
Yeah, I think history really matters here. Like what were the circumstances of the situation? Getting in touch with their psychiatrist, right? Getting in touch with their family. I also, remind people that, there are some AEs that, can take a long time to resolve. The neurocognitive effects don't take a long time to resolve. You stop the drug and within a couple of days, completely resolve. So to me, it's not a complete deal breaker, but I think it would depend on how long ago was it? What's the nature of the supports?
I was just going to say, I don't feel like we often take a good psychosocial history because like when I have patients on lorlatinib, they're not going to volunteer their auditory hallucinations. But if you ask them, they say, oh yeah, actually I have this. And so, it's the onus is a little bit on us to be kind of really drawing our patients out and seeing if they have issues.
By the way, the companion, the spouse is the best source of this information. They pick up on a lot of very subtle things. They're less talkative, they're more talkative, whatever. The other thing I would do, though, if I had concern about the suicidality, I would ask the basic questions. Do you have a plan? What was your attempt? Are you feeling suicidal now, family history? And also, the more worry I had, I would start with a lower dose. Yep.
And also closer follow-up. Like, I think there's a wide variety about how frequently we see these patients, especially when we're starting TKIs. And typically I start, every 2 weeks and scan at 6 weeks. But I had a patient very similar to this. And, I ended up seeing them every other week. It was me, the psychiatrist, we were touching base very frequently. And I think it's all about close monitoring, your nurse checking in, making a phone call.
Yep. So if the patient had no history of mood disorder, I don't think that's going to make a big difference for us. But if the patient was a commercial pilot?
This is something you would talk. You would have to talk to the healthcare people at the airline, and see what their criteria are for pilots. And it's amazed how these people are so knowledgeable of these issues. So you just got to talk to somebody and see if it's an issue or not.
Yeah. And, the reason I brought up this example, one, I do have a patient, he was right at the verge of retiring and he just said, I want to retire. But it did raise the question for us. And I find that sometimes, the neurocognitive stuff can be really subtle. Mm-hmm. I have a lawyer who just said, like, using double monitors, I'm having a really hard time multitasking at the high level that she wanted to be at. And so that was enough for me to actually dose reduce. What about a history of ILD?
I can't say that would necessarily hold me back, but it would definitely encourage me to discuss about the early symptoms of, an ILD flare and how to recognize that and coach my patient through how that would look like.
And it would push me away from pegatinib.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Because there's a short-term fall in DLCO in everybody, really. And you just don't want to have that. I mean, there's a ways around it, but it would make me take another drug.
Yeah. We were already okay with her BMI at 31, so 25. I don't think brain metastases are going to influence us here or LMD. So with that, maybe I'm recognizing your time is a little short, so I'm going to pass things over.
So I'm going to be talking about the multidisciplinary team in managing patients with ALK-positive non-small cell lung cancer. These are my disclosures. So first, I'm going to be talking about the BrightStar data, and then I'll just briefly touch upon BrightStar 2 up and coming, and then we'll talk about the multidisciplinary team as a group. So just a brief case, this is a patient that I met a couple of years ago, 41-year-old female, no smoking history, who was incidentally to have a left lower lobe mass, left hilar and subcarinal adenopathy when she was seen in the emergency room for abdominal pain. She subsequently underwent an EBUS in station 7 and left level 4 revealed non-small cell lung cancer adenocarcinoma, harboring an EML4 ALK fusion, and this was in December of 2020. This was diagnosed at an outside hospital. Her PET and MRI brain did not reveal any metastatic disease, and she was actually taken for left VATS, left lower lobectomy, mediastinal lymph node dissection locally, and intraoperatively, she was noted to have pleural studding, and the intraoperative procedure, everything was aborted, and the pleural biopsy was positive for adenocarcinoma. So she was started on frontline brigatinib locally, and then transferred to us for a second opinion. So after 3 months of therapy, these were her scans, her PET on the left and her CT cap on the right, still showing that maybe even scar of the left lower lobe mass. Her hilar adenopathy and subcarinal adenopathy had resolved. So I actually presented this case at Tumor Board wondering about a role for local therapy and the timing for that. So is there a role for local therapy here? Would we resect this, radiate, ablate, other? I didn't know, and I'll talk about what the outcome was. But so let's talk a little bit about the BrightStar data. So BrightStar was a study that was looking at the role of local consolidative therapy for patients with stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer harboring an ALK4 rearrangement that were started on brigatinib. So just to kind of cut to the chase, approximately 95% of patients who have an initial response to ALK TKIs exhibit an incomplete response. And this results in residual disease that may enable the emergence of acquired resistance alterations that we've heard about from Dr. Gaynor earlier today. So maybe minimizing or eliminating residual disease with local consolidative therapy may delay the development of these resistance alterations and improve clinical outcomes. So here's just a brief schema of the BrightStar data. Patients were over 18 years old, had stage 4 disease, and started on frontline brigatinib for about 8 weeks. Their PET and CT MRI brain were done that did not show progression of disease. And then they went on to get local consolidative therapy, and there was two different groups that they were really focusing on, those that had less than 3 sites of oligometastatic disease and those that had greater than 3 sites of disease. The primary objective is safety and tolerability, followed by PFS. So just a little bit about the patient characteristics. I found this interesting. So majority were adenocarcinoma. I don't think that's a surprise to us. Variant 1 and variant 3A slash B were the most common. Those are the most common variants that we see for patients that harbor ALK fusions. The number of metastases at baseline, the majority had over 3. And those that had an objective response to brigatinib, it was either partial response or stable disease, and the majority had partial response. So what kind of local control therapies were offered? Majority received radiation, followed by surgery and radiation. And then in regards to what was the extent of local control, 20% had complete extent of local control. So when talking about what kind of radiation modality was offered, it was mostly IMRT as opposed to SBRT, and I'm just wondering if that was location of disease or dealer's choice or just the radiation oncology team that was apparent at that time. And was brigatinib held during radiation? Majority of patients held it, but some did not. And I think that raises the concern about ILD. And then in regards to surgery, majority of patients underwent a lobectomy. So talking about toxicity, I was really expecting these patients have a very high rate of pneumonitis and, you know, even higher than grade 3, grade 4, I thought for sure. And I was very shocked to see that it was just N1 for grade 3, because I know I had mentioned here, as Dr. Chris had mentioned, the rate of ILD on brigatinib alone is reported at about 9%, but I think it may be higher than that. And there were no grade 5 events. So here we have the PFS curve, and as you can see, at 1 year, it was 94%, 2 years, it was 80%, and at 3 years, it was 66%, and this was for all comers, regardless of if you had less than 3 sites of metastases or greater than 3 sites of metastases. And then when compared to the ALTA-1 data, you can see at 3 years, we're looking at a 66% PFS versus a 43% PFS, and mind you, this is for all comers. So here we have a little bit about, well, who benefits most from local consolidative therapy? is it those that have no metastases at baseline? Is it the extent of their local control, or is it their ALK status in the plasma at baseline? And the numbers are really small here, so I'm just going to cut to the chase and summarize it, that the greatest PFS benefit was seen in patients that had one site of metastasis, complete local control, and actually a negative liquid biopsy at diagnosis. So to just conclude, brigatinib with local control is safe in patients with ALK rearranged non-small cell lung cancer. Brigatinib with local control did yield promising outcomes when compared to historical outcomes, with a three-year PFS at 66% in BrightStar compared to the 47% that was seen in the ALTA-1. PFS seemed to be the greatest in those, as I had said, with one site of metastasis, complete local control, and negative liquid biopsy at diagnosis. And there is a planned BrightStar 2 randomized trial that's looking to compare two intensification strategies, brigatinib plus local control versus brigatinib plus chemo with brigatinib alone as first-line therapy for ALK patients. So with that on hand, let's talk a little bit about the role of the multidisciplinary team. So who is part of the multidisciplinary team? I can speak for us at MSK. It's radiation oncologists, surgical oncologists, the players that you see listed there, and others. And what is the benefit of having a multidisciplinary approach to these patients? You get multiple opinions instantly. You adhere to guidelines. Someone may remind you of something or alert you of a newer approval. You have improved overall patient outcomes and a more comprehensive evaluation. Fortunately, we do live in an ivory tower, and I fully recognize that. And having, you know, very quick multidisciplinary discussions is not always possible. So some barriers to this may be that you work in a small rural practice, community practice. Subspecialties are located at all different sites, therefore making cross-communication very challenging. Tumor boards are really broad tumor boards, and maybe more surgical cases are being presented. So how can we move past these barriers, right? So what about setting up a virtual tumor board, including community oncology sites? We did this during fellowship. It was one of the projects that I was part of and was very fruitful. Regular scheduled case reviews within your team that sees thoracic oncology patients, attending CME activities and fostering collaborations, and of course, many, many other different opportunities. So I do want to thank our patients, and I know we have our discussion that's still underway, but I thank you, and I just want to be mindful of the time.
All right, so let's go down here and say if there are any final words. Dr. Yu?
No, I mean, I like what is said about, oh, and please answer, I guess, the post-test questions while we're talking. save time. I really like what is said about, I think that we underutilize local therapy for consolidation. I know that Dr. Iyengar talked earlier today about it in the larger population that that's not helpful, but I think we've really seen in these mutation-positive cancers with longer natural histories that makes sense. So that's my point.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would echo that. You know, we recently put together like a white paper in cancer discovery talking about like shifting the paradigm towards, you know, targeting residual disease. And can we use like a combination of tumor-informed ctDNA, radiomics to identify like who's most at risk? And, you know, I think, and then using the tissue from surgical resection or radiation to understand what are the mechanisms that contribute to these persister cell populations so that we can develop more informed interventions.
Yeah, I agree. And I think what that case just showed is that we don't know the right timing for when to pull the trigger on local therapy. And I presented the case, and at that time it said, you know, everyone said, you know, is the patient tolerating treatment? If she's tolerating treatment, keep going. And she's still on treatment. I actually presented her again a couple months ago, and that was the same answer. And I think, you know, if we don't offer local therapy, we'll never be able to collect a cohort of patients to kind of evaluate when the right time is and what are the outcomes of these patients. So seeing this data from BrightStar made me feel more confident about maybe proceeding and advocating a little bit more for my patients with residual disease.
And I think it was stated at the outset, these cases have a lot of unique characteristics, and it pays to think a little bit about it. I mean, one crazy thing, I people that have surgery with ALK-positive lung cancers have a worse prognosis. And that makes no sense to me. You know, you have this idea that it's well organized, it's adenocarcinoma, you find it earlier, and it's not true. It's actually, we had a project together with MGH, Jamie Chaft, and I forgot who it was from MGH, maybe it was you. and showing it, Mayo Clinic showed it too, so it happened. So it's a unique disease and needs to be thought of in that way. But you know, I think that to just summarize, we have so many ways of fighting this disease. You just have to have an open mind, engage the patient, be really cognizant of side effects. Don't be afraid to lower the dose. Don't be afraid to escalate rather than de-escalate the dose, particularly if there's a case like Dr. Yu's suicidal patient that, to me, their slow escalation would make sense if you, whatever drug you wanted to give, frankly. And with that, thank you for staying.
Thanks for listening to this PERspectives podcast. If you would like to receive CE credit for participating in this program, visit our podcast page on our website at gotoper.com. Find the name of this program and click on the link for the post-test. If you like today's episode, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening.